Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Russia yesterday brokered a truce between Azerbaijan and Turkey and Armenia to end fighting over the ethnically Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh that began in September when combined Azeri and Turkish forces mounted an attack to reclaim the enclave that's been autonomous since the early 1990s, but formerly part of Azerbaijan. Russia refused to become involved in the conflict that pitted Armenian troops in Nagorno-Karabakh against Turkish and Azeri forces using Turkish and Israeli unmanned systems and cluster munitions that killed thousands. The United States and international analysts were stunned that Russia declined to intervene, increasing Turkey's role in the region where Moscow has historically guarded its influence. Vladimir Putin always maintained that Russia's mutual security guarantee extends to Armenia, not a disputed enclave in Azerbaijan. The conflict also has proven to be a laboratory of what happens when even sophisticated forces are targeted by a new generation of autonomous air systems. Joining us to discuss the key takeaways from the conflict are two top Russia analysts from the Center for Naval Analyses, the director of the Russia program at CNA, Michael Kaufman, and Sam Bendett, one of the world's leading experts on Russia's unmanned systems, who's joined us frequently. Gentlemen, thanks very much for coming. Dobro pashalovat.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks for having me on your program.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year, presented virtually. Michael, start us off. What's at the core of this agreement? What does it mean and what's next?
It is not an unconditional surrender for Armenia, but it is fairly close to that, to a large extent to capitulation. So this agreement essentially requires that Armenia cede the territories that are already now occupied, retaken by Azerbaijani forces. And then by December, give up a substantial amount of territory controls. Armenia does get to keep Stepanakert, the capital of Nagorno-Karabakh, and regions and outlying towns around it. Armenian forces essentially have to withdraw, but they can maintain control of the Lachin corridor. This is a ground line of communications, a route that links the Nagorno-Karabakh capital to Armenia proper. However, Russian peacekeepers, which is essentially an airborne brigade, is going to deploy up to 2,000 into this corridor and will essentially take up responsibility for the security while a different road is built over the coming 3 years. Russian troops go in, and they go in on a five-year renewable basis. The agreement is a ceasefire. It is not a final political settlement, but I think it's likely to stick. The question of what's going to happen with Stepanakert or the Nagorno-Karabakh regions around it that Armenia gets to hold on to, which is a small percentage of the territory now left that was being fought over, is unsettled. That's why I say expressly it does not a final political settlement. Also, Azerbaijan gets a corridor to its exclave region on the western side of Armenia. For those familiar with the geography of Nakhichevan, gets a small basic corridor there through the southern strip of Armenia proper. All right, so in conclusion, what you're really looking at is a defeat for Armenia. Russia negotiating a settlement for Armenia that I honestly think is the best deal they were going to get based on the military situation on the ground. Armenia's situation had grown completely untenable once Azerbaijani forces had in effect captured Shusha, which also could control the ground line of communication to the rest of Armenia's forces, and eventually they'd be cut off and besieged, and Armenia would have to just agree to an unconditional surrender. Whereas as bitter of a pill this might be to swallow for Armenia, it's still a better deal than the alternative. And we can discuss the political ramifications and sort of the interests of the different parties inside, but that's essentially what the agreement looks like now.
Sam, you joined us a couple of weeks ago for analysis on the systems being used and the landmark characteristics of this conflict, right? You noted that no future conflict will be too small to involve unmanned precision strike systems. And in fact, you also made the case that this likely takes the lid off of other sort of simmering nationality conflicts that stemmed after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Any other key takeaways as the fighting both ground on, but then eventually ended?
Well, I think it's important to highlight, in addition to what you have summarized, is that this conflict was fought with a force that really wasn't that well protected or camouflaged. I think if the Nagorno-Karabakh and the Armenian military had better defenses, if they had really better prepared for this conflict, I think Azeri drones may have had a more difficult time trying to target the Armenians and Nagorno-Karabakh soldiers. As such, their job was made a bit easier in that sort of purely objective sense, because the Nagorno-Karabakh and the Armenian forces were not that well protected. At the same time, this conflict really underscores the significance of relatively cheap, relatively inexpensive aerial systems that can target potential adversaries practically at will. And even if such drones cannot penetrate sophisticated air defenses or sophisticated defenses in general of a better prepared adversary, they are at least forcing that adversary to reveal itself and expend its munitions. So once again, this conflict underscores the significance of unmanned aerial assets when matched very well with a very willing ground force that is willing to go on and take casualties to accomplish the objective.
You know, in this particular conflict, what was interesting is the extent to which, for example, the planning that went into it, Turkey obviously urging Azerbaijan to start the conflict, and also Turkey's active role in moving thousands of Syrian fighters to the border, which did in fact become a little bit of the cannon fodder at the end of the day, at least on the Azeri side. Michael, I think the international community is still somewhat baffled why Russia didn't act in an area where it's always regarded as being the power broker, and certainly not let another great power like Turkey, and one with growing interests in Central Asia, to basically operate unchecked in all of this. What did Erdogan have to give Putin in order to get this, right? I mean, these guys are sort of great power in the oldest sense, you know, sort of great power, great man leaders. Why didn't Putin become involved? And what did he get for not becoming involved in this? Because it would seem that he actually weakened his own hand in an area where these kind of things are more likely to happen than not.
Russia did act. It brokered the agreement de facto single-handedly. This is the outcome of the deal. Now Russian forces occupy the middle of that territory and are deployed on Azerbaijani territory along with Armenian territory, where they have been for a long time. So let me rewind the tape a bit, because I never understood where that perspective came from and what it is that people actually expected Russia to do. Like, what's the counterfactual on what Russia does in this scenario over the course of all of the last 5 weeks that this thing plays out differently? I'm just not really clear on what it is they anticipated.
I think the anticipation was that the Russians would have acted in some capacity to stop the fighting much earlier before it got to this point, because it could have posted troops pretty much wherever it wanted to anyway at the end of the day, right? I mean, I don't think this is the outcome that was necessary, right? Armenia didn't have to be defeated in order for Russia to be able to exact some sort of form of concession. I think that's what a lot of folks, whether here or anywhere else, are asking, is why on earth didn't he get involved sooner? I agree with you that he did get involved and did broker an agreement. But the question is, why not get involved sooner?
Sure. Let me get into that conversation. It's really worth unpacking. First, there are a couple of challenges that Russia had very clear stakes, and they were quite different with all three other parties in this conflict. The first one was Armenia, which people see as Russia's ally, but from Russia's perspective, is actually its client state. The second one is Azerbaijan, with whom Russia has important relations and important economic relations, right? The third one is Turkey, with whom Russia has an extensive relationship as well, along with many areas of competition, but they try to compartmentalize those to the extent they can because they have also very strong political and economic relations, right? Looking at the situation going into this conflict first, there's very clear reason why Russia did not intervene early on Armenia's behalf, okay? Armenia's political leadership made very bad choices, both vis-a-vis their relationship with Russia in the years running up to this, since Pashinyan took over, and on how they behaved in terms of negotiating, or at least pretending to want to negotiate some status for this region with Azerbaijan, especially in the last ceasefire that Russia brokered on its behalf. And Russia's been brokering ceasefires on the behalf of these parties now since time immemorial, going back the last 30 years, right? Back in when fighting broke out between Armenia and Azerbaijan proper over the summer. Unfortunately, Pashinyan, I think, made very, very poor choices. And actually, it became quite clear that it was first in Russia's interest to see Armenian forces essentially defeated and him politically undercut and replaced, which I think is quite likely was going to happen. Second, Armenia moving back from sort of the perception Yerevan had that they were Russia's ally and they had their own independent foreign policy to really Russia's client state, which is, I think, the way Moscow looks at it. Third, it was Russia's goal not to ruin relations with Azerbaijan. And when you're getting into it, when you're in a place where both these countries go to war, they're not strong options for how you can maneuver between these two eventualities. So the Russian goal was first and foremost to resist Turkish insertion of itself into this region and a Turkish contest for Russia's position as determined as a country able to determine security outcomes. What Turkey wanted to do in this conflict was essentially to force a 2+2 negotiating framework onto Russia, where Turkey represents Azerbaijan. Russia is not the security arbiter between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Russia represents Armenia. And then Turkey negotiates on Azerbaijan's behalf with Russia. They nix the OSCE Minsk contact group. And now Russia is forced to deal directly with Turkey to negotiate what's going to happen in the Caucasus, right? And as you see, for Russia, this would have been probably a bit of a bridge too far, where their view was, okay, so the situation now is a bit more important than a contest between Armenia and Azerbaijan over territory that Russia couldn't possibly care less about, right? Which is Nagorno-Karabakh. This territory has 0.0 strategic significance or relevance to Russia in terms of outcomes in this region.
Right.
Okay. So the conversation, right. So you have to look at it from at least a Moscow perspective. So the conversation then became about Turkey and the future of the balance of relations and power with Turkey in the region. When the conversation came to that, it became very clear that Russia refused to be positioned as Armenia's representative being forced to negotiate with Turkey over what happens here. Russia wanted to be the security arbiter between Armenia and Azerbaijan. That would come at the price of Armenian interests, but from Russia's perspective, Armenia made very poor choices as well, specifically in their relations with Moscow. And so Russia essentially sacrificed Armenia's interests in order to maintain its role and position, which, by the way, you should not be surprised at all, because Russia has a very long established tradition of not treating its allies all that well. Right. So this is fairly consistent, actually, for Moscow. I'm always puzzled when people are surprised. They say, these people are Russia's allies and Russia doesn't treat them well. Right. And I'm like, yeah, but this is kind of how it is historically. Russia has a strong reputation for that.
That's very true. And right. I mean, Russia has also made it abundantly clear. It's not interested in supporting velvet revolutions. And Pashinyan was vaulted into power 2 years ago, albeit, you know, ushering in sort of a new era of prosperity in Armenia. The flip side is, you know, there was no way that Putin was going to forgive this sort of change to go unpunished at the end of the day, whether or not he made good decisions or not, because there was always a sense that there was going to be some form of punishment at the end of the day. I mean, and that even extended to the debate that was going on in the country that, hey, we should invest a lot more in unmanned aerial systems instead of buying 4 Sukhois. At the end of the day, when Moscow says you're going to buy 4 Sukhois for $100 million, the client state ends up buying 4 Sukhois for $100 million. I mean, obviously, there's going to be a lot of spleen vetting at the end of this. From your perspective, Sam, any other points that you want to add on that from a strategic perspective?
Well, I think it's interesting, and I think the postmortem of this conflict will show the thinking inside the Armenian Ministry of Defense as they were no doubt collecting information on Azerbaijan, or were at least witness to Azerbaijan's very public acquisitions of unmanned aerial vehicles. Obviously, UAVs were not the panacea here, but they were kind of that straw that broke the camel's back. And again, I reiterate that it was the ground forces and mechanized infantry that actually won this conflict for Azerbaijan. And of course, they were greatly augmented and helped by numerous unmanned aerial systems imported from Israel and Turkey. And so the question, of course, for Armenia and for other countries looking at sort of their future force posture and defense posture is, what do we prioritize? How do we prioritize? And where do we invest? And I also want to add that Armenia actually has a domestic drone industry. It's relatively small, but Armenia actually is manufacturing its own UAVs. They were not the kind of UAVs that made a difference in this conflict, but they also have knowledge in producing and fielding intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance UAVs and drones, as well as sort of they were inching towards creating their own combat and loitering munition UAVs. But again, the question is that of priorities, and you covered that in your previous discussion with Michael just now. How does a nation prioritize, and what does it put an emphasis on, and why didn't Armenian Ministry of Defense pay more attention or closer attention to their adversary's acquisition of these new systems?
Obviously, because in part also because they've been going on for a long time and were remarkably public. Michael, do you get a sense that, as Sam has said, that this kind of does blow the lid off of other simmering conflicts that are likely to erupt over the coming years, right? I mean, if you go throughout the region, there are a whole bunch of these sorts of territorial historical overhangs.
I mean, I'm probably not a person who subscribes as much to technology deterministic theories, especially when it comes to tactical level capabilities. But I think the important takeaway here, I'll add to Sam's comments, is that the one thing that we do learn from here, and we have to be very careful, because in a sustained great power interregnum, people are very thirsty for lessons from any conflict on characteristics of modern warfare. And so they have a terrible tendency to generalize from a very specific context to try to imagine what this means for, you know, great power war and all this. So you have to be careful not to overconsume lessons from these types of small wars. Essentially, that the drone power takes what is a very expensive capability, essentially an air force with precision weapons and the ability to do close air support and things like that, and makes incredibly affordable for even a small power. And that this technology is very easy and cheap to diffuse, and it's going to diffuse a lot faster than adapted air defense or specific counters to warfare with drone platforms, right? And that's just worth taking note of. The other big part of, you know, helps answer some interesting questions on modern warfare. For example, those who thought that existing legacy air defense could be easily adapted to deal with a drone threat, particularly loitering munitions, that's clearly not true. Not at all. The second one is militaries that have very poor support to maneuver ratio, where they have a lot of tanks and armored vehicles, but they have very little air defense. It's not integrated. It's not layered. They don't have much in electronic warfare. Those militaries are going to suffer pretty big attrition. And when you're kind of looking at this, we've had lots of fun debates on kind of what this means for the future battlefield. I see it more as a confirming event in terms of many things already known about modern warfare in late 20th century. But and there's not huge takeaways of things that are new, new for me here. But the Azeri accomplishment at the tactical level was quite significant. The Armenian military, Vaga, was very, very much out to lunch. I mean, it fought very hard, but in terms of how they had prepared and set up, given both the correlation of forces, quantitative and qualitative, given what Azerbaijanis had invested in, was very poor. It's just not really clear if they had all prepared for the tremendous amount of attrition they would suffer to loitering munitions and drone power. The one big piece of credit you can give them, and that's an important takeaway from this conflict as well, that despite the amount of losses they had suffered in the early weeks of this war, Armenia's defense effort did not collapse. Neither did command and control. They retreated to reserve lines, nor were Azerbaijanis effectively able to interdict their ground lines of communications. They attritioned them over time such that they could take the territory, But overall, Azerbaijan's progress was very fitful as well. And they too were struggling to make tactical victories add up to an operational success that would sort of bring them to a clear sort of strategy that would decisively end this conflict. They definitely got there. But if you watch playback the footage on this war in the first couple of weeks, it looked very, very rough for Azerbaijani forces as well.
Look, as an air power advocate, all I'll tell you is, when you dominate the sky, whether for reconnaissance or whether for a strike, even the best ground army is going to get attrited at the end of the day. So, I mean, that's kind of the interesting thing. And again, folks are going to get into a deeper discussion. And I'm not here to advocate one argument over another or what they should have or could have done on either side. I'm just interested in terms of the laboratory that it is for the future, in part because of how it turned out. The one question I think, right, there's the one way of looking at this, not to use an Israeli parlance, but even Armenians and as well as other strategists are looking at this in sort of a Yom Kippur war kind of thing, that actually Armenia's past successes may have fueled overconfidence in terms of what its capabilities were vis-a-vis to what adversaries are, right? I mean, there were some in the IDF who were saying, hey, look at what the Russians are doing. You know, they're getting these kind of missiles, they're getting these capabilities, and the IDF didn't respond to that in 1973. Things got very, very sporty in terms of the outcome. Although there's also a sense that Israel entered sort of a new prosperous age, and there are folks who are making the case that, you know, look, this sort of alleviates a burden. It clears the way for a more prosperous future. There are others who argue, actually, that this is maybe the beginning of the end, because Turkey will be further emboldened. The Russians may not actually come to Armenia's defense. In fact, there is this sense that nobody will come to Armenia's defense in the event that Turkey does want to wage a wider conflict that gets rid of, you know, and I've said this before, right? Looking at it strategically, there were a lot of very good reasons the Turks engaged in the Armenian genocide, because it was like, hey, look, there's this Christian speed bump to a pan-Turanic world that extends right to the Chinese border. So that was their strategic rationale. At the end of the day, I mean, should there be that sense of hopelessness for some, certainly in Yerevan, that look at this as it's only a matter of time before the notion of an independent state is eliminated? In part, Michael, as you eloquently said, anybody who's ever banked on Russia being a good and reliable ally has normally ended up being surprised.
Yeah, that's a great question. Probably if I was Armenian, I would not despair, because at the end of the day, you have a very sizable Russian military presence on the Armenian-Turkish border, which is primarily what it's there for, to deter the Turks. Russian military deployed from that base all the way to Armenia's eastern border and the new line of contact with Azerbaijani forces during this war as a deterrent force to make it clear to Azerbaijanis that no, they should not have any ideas about retaking actual Armenian territory as opposed to territory that is internationally recognized to be theirs. And they set up two outposts. In fact, that's part of what cost them that MI-24 that Azerbaijanis accidentally shot down yesterday across the border. It was a Russian contingent redeploying. So in that regard, I think it's a bit unfair to say that Russia was not forthcoming vis-a-vis its commitments for Armenia's security, okay? I would not despair on that account if I was Armenia. But when it comes to Nagorno-Karabakh and that self-declared Republic of Austria, as Vladimir Putin basically said, largely almost anything goes. And now, given the losses Armenia suffered, Russia has effectively maneuvered it back into being a full dependency and itself into the role of the country that is still the preeminent arbiter of the security dynamic between Armenia and Azerbaijan and this conflict. And so I think essentially the story of this war is that Armenia is very clearly the decisive loser, and Turkey, Azerbaijan, and Russia also are in their own respective ways all winners. They all got much of what they wanted. Turkey perhaps didn't get everything it wanted, but it definitely achieved gains here.
And what did Turkey want, right? I mean, what was the Turkish interest? Because there were some who were saying that actually Turkey was the one who was sort of precipitating and pushing this Are there any, right, what was in it for Turkey? Because it further soured relations, for example, among many NATO nations and Turkey as a consequence of this at a time when Turkey is not exactly the most popular nation in the Atlantic Alliance.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. I mean, it isn't. In fact, you know, Russians don't really see Turkey as really being fully in NATO. They see it as an independent actor, a country that often acts completely off page from NATO policy or NATO interests or the interests of its allies, just to give you kind of a Russian take on Turkey. Russia sees Turkey as sort of a regional power that's off on its own and is also in NATO and plays with NATO sometimes and other times just buys Russian S-400s, does what it wants. That makes sense. Deploys F-16s into Azerbaijan to become a material party to a war, right? So it feels that first, Turkey very much wanted to expand its influence in the Caucasus, right? And it wanted to position itself not as just an ally and supporter of Azerbaijan, but as an actual arbiter of security outcomes in the region, right? Which will essentially be a real gain at Russia's expense. And that's not really what happened here. I'll be frank. At least my point of view, that's not the net outcome of this agreement. Turkey also very much wanted to repay Russia and has been trying to repay Russia for complete Russian vetoing of Turkish foreign policy in Syria, which is very visible and very painful for Turkey. And you can see that playing out in Libya and a little bit here, because that loss was very close to home, if people remember actual Turkish foreign policy to overthrow Assad and all the forces they backed. Right. And all the proxies that got killed. That's still sort of an ongoing thing in Syria. So that's another, this is sort of the third contest between these two powers when we look at it from a geopolitical perspective. And, you know, the third thing I'd say here is that Turkey was very much successful in demonstrating, and maybe Sam, you should jump in on this, in demonstrating its role as a technology exporter, which maybe for some of us who just haven't followed Turkish defense tech or some niche capabilities, like the success of their TB2 drones over the past couple of years, they've sort of they've dramatically increased their profile. So probably this will have very positive net effects for their defense industry, at least when it comes to these technologies.
Sam?
I agree with Mike. If you looked at Turkey 10 years ago, it really wasn't the drone sort of power it is today. Besides the TB2, there are at least three or four other major UAV projects that are nearing completion. Turkey is developing its own long-range combat UAVs that will compete with America's Global Hawk or with Israeli drones. Certainly, right now, Turkey showed that it could be ahead of established defense powers like Russia when it comes to unmanned aerial vehicle development, especially for the military. So yeah, I agree, this will have a very positive effect. I think Turkish developments will take a close look by a number of importers, and this demonstrates the diffusion argument that now a country willing to import UAVs will have another sort of source to look at besides other established sources. And of course, this probably gives impetus for further development of Turkey high-tech weapon systems. Turkey has reached out to Ukraine. It's reached out to other countries. It is working on a bilateral, multilateral, and of course, its own sort of unique basis in developing these systems. And this conflict underscored that a mix of new technology together with the old technology can actually achieve desired results.
The question is whether at the end of the day, anybody in Yerevan or whether folks in Yerevan are paying as close attention to that as you just said, Sam, right? I mean, given that last time when we were talking, you know, even you found it surprising, given that in general, their intelligence and planning tends to be pretty methodical and seems to have been a little bit less so in this case. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to get both of your senses on this. There was a report, albeit not from the most reliable source last week, that Russian political pundit Valery Soloviev, who said that Putin has Parkinson's and he's going to be stepping down next year, a suggestion that the Kremlin has flatly denied, putting his health aside. Putin has a longer list of headaches going into 2021 than he did going into 2020. What are some of the most pressing challenges that are sitting on his doorstep? Because there is this theory that Vladimir Putin was distracted, you know, in this case. And so that's one of the reasons why he wasn't as particularly involved. I think, Michael, you've done a compelling, you know, argument about what the driving factors were. But from your standpoint, what are the challenges that Vladimir Putin faces, right? I mean, COVID was a challenge. He has a Navalny challenge. He has a Belarus challenge. He had this challenge, which he seems to have gotten off of his plate. What are the challenges that are sitting on his plate as he goes into what could be a very, very interesting 2021 at a time when a Biden administration is going to take office that is going to take a much harder line with the Russians?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vago. So as always, you have internal, you have external challenges. You have big internal challenges for United Russia and regional politics, where it's, you know, the sort of titular ruling party is going to get politically decimated and consistently so in regional elections. That's in part why I think they attempted to assassinate Navalny. Politics is really back in Russia. And it's hard to see for people who kind of get minor snapshots of this country. They don't really get a feel for it. But the truth is there are political changes taking place in Russia, even though from the outside it looks like an ossifying authoritarian regime. And those things are very challenging for that regime. And it has to in some place get increasingly repressive. And in another place, it has to be nuanced in how it tries to maneuver. But there are a lot of internal challenges to, I won't say it's like political stability, because it's kind of a crass term. It doesn't tell you anything. But to him, from the inside. External challenges, well, you have Belarus. What's going to happen with Lukashenko is very much in question. And you don't know if this is going to end ultimately with the need for some sort of Russian intervention, if this will blow up in Russia's face, if the opposition will turn and not just, you know, anti-Lukashenko, but also turn anti-Russian. Belarus is a long-term challenge. How this plays out may actually determine in the long run whether or not Russia ends up using force in Belarus, whether or not even Russia comes into blows with some Baltic states over how Belarus plays out. The really interesting security dynamics here that you have to have kind of the art of, not the long view, because we don't do that in the United States, but definitely the near to medium term view, okay? At least the next 5 years. Beyond that, of course, economic outcome from COVID. That'll be really interesting to see how Russia fares in this coming year. And you have a host of political instability and other challenges on Russia's periphery. Because remember, beyond Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia and Azerbaijan, there are also really interesting things taking place in Central Asia. And so you see increasingly the former Soviet space, at least in recent years, is politically very vibrant. It's a bit unstable. There are lots of challenges and crises there that Russia has to react to. Plus, one of their biggest ones undoubtedly will be what to do with the new incoming administration reacting to their policies. Russia's perpetually in somewhat of a defensive crouch economically in fear of new rounds of sanctions or more severe sanctions.
Sam, your sense?
I agree with Michael. I think there are a host of issues that Russia will have to deal that are very close to home. They are telegraphing that they want to repair bilateral relations with the United States if the Biden administration takes control in January. They're also telegraphing that their COVID situation is still very much in flux and can possibly get worse, although they're saying no quarantines and no limitations will probably be imposed. But I think repairing the post-COVID aftermath, the economic devastation that the coronavirus has wrought on Russia will probably be very much front and center on the Putin administration agenda, especially because there were previous protests against some of the poor handling of the economic situation by the Russian government. Those protests were ultimately not as effective as probably the people have desired. But again, I think Russia will try to strengthen its domestic posture, improve the economy, and improve relations with the United States. I think tacking on that would be continuing to strengthen their relations with China. And actually, Russian president has telegraphed on multiple occasions that they're looking forward to expanding their cooperation with China on multiple fronts.
And Michael, in about 30 seconds, building on what Sam just said, how should the new administration be approaching Russia? We're going to do a deeper show on this, but just want to get your brief sense on whether it should be more confrontational, as folks expect, to be more cooperative. What's the right approach for the new team to be taking?
I would say deliberate. U.S. approach to Russia thus far has been a sort of a lowest common denominator consensus, and it's been one part active pressure campaign with no obvious objective, another part working to some extent with allies and improving deterrence and all that. But I think the new team needs to really reassess parts of the defense strategy. It needs to get the keys back from Congress in terms of U.S. sanctions policy and actually figure out what the purpose and point of that policy is. I don't see any real good room necessarily for engagement with Russia, but I think there's room for a much more strategic approach to Russia, one that has clear priorities, clear choices, and also reflects kind of a longer perspective on, okay, at some point, we must also not foreclose opportunities if either regime in Russia changes or it remains the same, but nonetheless choose a different approach, you know, to be able to essentially get something done with Russia, because Russia's not going anywhere at the end of the day. Right. And that's important, too. And that's the one thing that probably drives me crazy the most in U.S. defense deliberations. There's a belief that Russia is going to go away and become less of a threat because we would like it to, because we really want to focus on China. But no one's consulted the Russians on this plan.
As usual, Michael, you have a skill for understatement. Sam, thanks very much. Michael, thanks very much. It's always a real pleasure talking to you both. Thanks very much for joining us and looking forward already to having you guys back on. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.